AU Press presents Under the Nakba Tree, Fragments of a Palestinian Family in Canada, written by Muafa Saeed Hausa, narrated by Paul Deuter. This work is copyrighted 2022, Muafa Saeed Hausa, and published by Athabasca University Press. Cover design by Natalie Olson. We acknowledge the support of the Government of Canada for our publishing activities, as well as the assistance provided by the Government of Alberta through the Alberta Media Fund. Our Lives, Diary, Memoir, and Letters. Social history contests the construction of the past as the story of elites, a grand narrative dedicated to the actions of those in power. Our Lives seeks instead to make available voices from the past that might otherwise remain unheard. By foregrounding the experience of ordinary individuals, the series aims to demonstrate that history is ultimately the story of our lives, lives constituted in part by our response to the issues and events of the era into which we are born. Many of the voices in the series thus speak in the context of political and social events of the sort about which historians have traditionally written. What they have to say fills in the details, creating a richly varied portrait that celebrates the concrete, allowing broader historical settings to emerge between the lines. The series invites materials that are engagingly written and that contribute in some way to our understanding of the relationship between the individual and the collective. Manuscripts that include an introduction or epilogue that contextualizes the primary materials and reflects on their significance will be preferred. About the author. Muafa Saeed Hausa's family fled Palestine in 1948 and arrived in Canada in the 1970s. He spent his childhood in Edmonton, Alberta, where he grew up as a visible minority and a Muslim with a deeply fractured family history. In the year 2000, when Muafa visited his family's homeland of Palestine at the beginning of the Second Intifada, he witnessed the effects of prolonged conflict and occupation. His experience not only inspired him to tell his story, but awakened him to the intergenerational and colonial traumas he shares with the indigenous people of Turtle Island. His moving memoir depicts the lives of those who live on occupied land and the struggles that define them. Dedication. For my people and their struggle for freedom. Contents. 1. Fleeing and Frozen, page 1. 2. Calls to Prayer, page 9. 3. A Circle of Tears, page 17. East, page 23. 4. The Price of Slippers, page 25. 5. Planting Saplings, page 37. 6. In the Line of Fire, page 47. West, page 59. 7. Uprisings, page 61. 8. Fighting Back, page 67. 9. Wise Mentors, Rough Waters, page 79. 10. A Thirst for Knowledge, page 93. North, page 119. 11. Flying to Amman, page 121. 12. Welcome to Al-Quds, page 129. 13. The Children of Palestine, page 135. 14. Chaos at Masjid Al-Aqsa, page 141. 15. Violence in the Streets, page 147. 16. Family Ties, page 157. 17. Surrounded by Family in the Middle of a War, page 167. South, page 177. 18. Crossing Borders, page 179. 19. At First Sight, page 185. 20. Putting Down New Roots, page 193. Epilogue, Half Belonging in the World, page 201. Acknowledgements, page 203. Epigraph. Exile is strangely compelling to think about, but terrible to experience. It is the unhealable rift forced between a human being and a native place, between the self and its true home, its essential sadness, can never be surmounted. And while it is true that literature and history contain heroic, romantic, glorious, even triumphant episodes in an exile's life, these are no more than efforts meant to overcome the crippling sorrow of estrangement. The achievements of exile are permanently undermined by the loss of something left behind forever. Edward Said, Reflections on Exile. 1. Fleeing and Frozen. We really would like to thank you for all this hospitality and the warm welcome and all the staff. We felt ourselves at home, and we felt ourselves highly respected. Kevork Jamkosian, one of the first Syrian refugees to arrive in Canada on 11 December 2015, told Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. "Welcome home," the new Prime Minister replied. It was not always like that. Not for everybody. For Palestinians, home is a complicated term, and hospitality is not the first Canadian character trait I think of when I try to describe my experience of growing up Muslim in Canada. Snow was falling in southwest Calgary as the afternoon light began to fade that December evening in 2013. Soon it would be time for the Maghrib prayer. My father and I were sitting at my brother's kitchen table, snacking on a bowl of chips and chatting before dinner. I looked over at my father. "Yaba, remember when you made me stand outside Al Rashid Mosque with a gun?" "Yes, of course. I don't think I will ever forget that time." He spoke in Arabic, as he always has to his children. It was his small way of protecting his heritage and his new home in his adopted country, Canada. "Of course I remember," I said. "Here is your weapon." I, too, remember that day. My father had handed me an unloaded $20 pellet gun and left me at the doors of Al Rashid Mosque, the oldest mosque in his new country. There I stood on a December evening in 1990, a frightened 13-year-old Palestinian boy holding a gun in this welcoming home the Prime Minister and Kevork Jamkosian had spoken about. I paced in and out of the double doors, trying to stay visible, trying to stay warm. I should not have been there at all. I was a teenager trying to discover how I fit into this world, a child who suddenly found himself thrown into an adult world. I still had to learn that adulthood comes early in Palestine and that my teenage fears were trivial by comparison to what I witnessed when I visited Palestine a few years later. But that night, this terrifying and violent world was still new to me. I was not afraid of someone attacking the mosque, as much as I was worried that people might question me and that I would not know how to respond, or that the police might find the gun. I felt confused but ready to defend my community at all costs. As my father and I chatted, it struck me that more than two decades had passed since the first Persian Gulf War of 1990-91, when the chaos George W. Bush unleashed with the American invasion of Iraq became the pretext under which Canadians had joined an international coalition to defeat Saddam Hussein after Iraq had invaded neighboring Kuwait. It was the first time Canadian troops had seen active duty in many years, and many people were proud to be part of this international coalition. As a child at the time of the Gulf War, I did not understand all the nuances the adults were discussing, but with the unerring acumen of youth, I understood what mattered and felt the ramifications to my core. Saddam was Muslim and an Arab. I was Muslim and an Arab. In the minds of other teenagers at school, that made me the target. In this battle between the United States of America and Saddam Hussein, I became the enemy, and there was no place for me and my family in these self-involved displays of Canadian patriotic spirit. Islam and living our faith were important to my mother when we were children, and it still is. She taught us how to pray and memorize parts of the Quran. When we moved to Jordan for a few years, my family lived conservatively and devoutly. When we moved back to Canada in 1988 and I started grade 6, I felt the culture shock and struggled to fit in. I continued to pray, but did so less and less often. By grade 8, I had stopped praying altogether because it wasn't cool. No one among my friends at school prayed except when they were at the mosque, and I did not want to be the odd one out among them when I already felt ostracized from other communities in Edmonton. Slowly, I grew apart from my faith, but I continued to lie to my mother when she asked about my faith, telling her that I prayed regularly. Perhaps my own alienation from my faith and my culture and my desire to fit into the broader community in Edmonton contributed to my shock at how badly Muslims were treated when the Gulf War broke out in 1990. The only way I knew how to respond to the hatred I saw and felt was to emphasize who I am, a Palestinian Muslim. My embrace of this identity was also inspired by Yazan Haymour, the president of the Canadian Arab Friendship Association, who taught us to be proud of being Arab and to acknowledge our many achievements throughout history. And so began a slow and troubled journey back to my faith and into my sense of being Arab in this world. Although my father believed in God, he was not especially religious, but he was angry. For my father, meeting at the mosque with other families was the thing to do for the community at the time. So the mosque became part of our lives. The imam of our mosque had spoken out in opposition to Canada's participation in the war, and now the mosque, a symbol of our struggle to arrive, worship, and belong in this self-proudly multicultural country, had been vandalized. Spray paint trickled ominously down the pristine white walls, and everyone wondered whether the mosque would be the target of further attacks. No one had called on the community to defend the mosque, yet I was pressed into duty. My father had never been politically minded and did not get involved in politics all that often, but he did support the struggle for the liberation of Palestine. This war affected him and people he knew personally, and the only way he knew to show his support and to feel like he was doing something to assist his people in a time of need was to make me stand out in the cold and dark with an unloaded Canadian Tire pellet gun. And he expected me not to snivel, get angry, or beg to go home. Home. It is a word that haunts me. My father was 6 months old when the Israeli Defense Forces swept into Lida, Palestine, in July 1948. As The New Yorker reported in October 2013, Yitzhak Rabin, the deputy commander of Operation Danny, the code name for the capture of Ramla and Lida, gave clear instructions. The inhabitants of Lida must be expelled quickly, without regard to age. Lida, my father's home, the home of his parents and his grandparents, the home that he would never know. As the IDF swept into town, some residents remained. Others fled. My grandfather Mahmoud, my grandma Nima, and 8 of their 9 children were among those who fled to the Arab front lines. One son, Darwish, chose to stay and fight and rejoined the family later. My grandparents had heard that the Arab Legion was waiting at the end of the road in Barfilia to provide shelter and supplies to the people who made it there. But one hot summer night along the way, facing exhaustion, thirst, hunger, and uncertainty, my grandmother had a terrible decision to make. She was a large woman and strong, but this was too much for her. Hoping someone else would find him and care for him, she wrapped her baby son in a blanket and left him under a tree. 10 long minutes later, she panicked. She sent 2 of her other sons, Faisal and Saleh, back to get the infant, screaming at them, gasping that they must go, now, quickly. The baby was soon back in her aching arms, his dark eyes looking up at her. She held him close, and the journey continued. My father would grow up in the El Hussein refugee camp in Amman, Jordan, where he eventually became a pharmacy assistant and used his knowledge of medicines to serve people from the camp. As an adult, he would trade the hills of Jordan and Palestine for the plains of Alberta, Canada. In Alberta, thousands of miles away from the places of his birth and childhood, he would become part of another displaced Arab-Muslim community. It was a place where his Jordanian pharmaceutical diploma was of no use. His pharmacist's hands became worn and tough in a cement factory. Then he worked as a traveling salesman. As an immigrant to a country founded on displacement, my father again became a success at serving people. All families have their standard jokes and stories that help them stick together, even in the face of adversity. According to one of our family stories, when my grandmother sent Faisal and Saleh back to rescue the infant she had abandoned, they accidentally picked up the wrong child. To this day, if my dad's behavior seems erratic or his character flawed, like when someone asks why he isn't as devout as the rest of his family, someone is bound to tell that story. Now, in 2013, my father and I were sitting at the kitchen table in Calgary. I had come from Saudi Arabia, where I was working at that time, to be at this family reunion, along with my wife, who was expecting our third child, and our two daughters. I gazed out the frosted window of my brother's home and watched my children playing with their cousins in the snow. I thought of the children growing up under Israeli occupation. My Canadian nieces and nephews might be called little terrorists by angry whites, but they were relatively secure. They did not have to grow up too soon, like so many Palestinian children in the occupied territories of East Jerusalem, the Gaza Strip, and the West Bank, where lethal encounters are as commonplace as walking to school. Their parents did not have to sneak out at night to try to find food, running and hiding, risking being shot or captured, while their families waited locked inside their homes, praying for them to come back alive. Dinner was a time when everyone could get together and share stories. My father and I tucked into the feast before us, tearing off pieces of flatbread, the tastiest way to scoop up a piece of kebab and a dollop of hummus, while we listened to the conversations and stories happening around the table. Across the array of aromatic dishes, recipes passed down among family members, along with the stories of our survival, I looked at my father and uncles who had grown up in a camp. Not much meat to scoop up there, I thought. With that body memory of hunger, how do they experience eating now? At times in our family history, food, real food, was only a distant memory. That hunger, not only for nourishment but also for some measure of stability, has never left my father. Anyone who goes to his place for dinner must stay until they have gained 10 pounds, and he will weigh them. Well, that's an exaggeration, but I can feel how he is trying to compensate for previous imbalances by piling the food onto your plate. My brothers and sister and I have asked him about his difficult childhood. Tears well up in his eyes as he tells us, "I wish I could have been a better father, but I grew up in a camp and didn't know any better." I have an old photo of myself with him on the couch. Over the course of many moves around the world, the photo has been buried in a box I can't find, but I only need to close my eyes to see it. In the photo, I'm sporting a young man's beard, and I have my arm around him. But the composition of the photo looks forced. He is sitting in the corner, not smiling, shrinking away even as my arm extends to link us. After enduring as much hardship as he had while growing up, it was difficult for him to express things. All the same, he had agreed to let me record his stories during this visit, and I sat listening to him. Some stories I had already heard, and, as he shared more, I realized that my father was not alone in these stories. They were the stories of my family. They were Palestinian stories, stories of displacement, separation, and sacrifice, and of solidarity and survival. 2. Calls to Prayer. My name is Mu'afa Saeed Hausa. This is not the whole truth. My name in Arabic is Mowafaq. In English, it sounds like Mowafaq. I did not change my name legally, but in grade 8, I dropped the last letter to stop the endless bullying, and no one asked. In the Levant dialect of Arabic, the dialect my mother speaks, the Q is silent. To her, I have always been Mu'afa. And now I was that to the rest of the world, too. I am the first son and first child of Saeed Hausa and Hanan Hunaim, and I was named Saeed for my father. This is the custom in our culture. A father's first name becomes the middle name of his children, be they sons or daughters. The practice serves to identify one's paternal lineage, and it goes back to the earliest times, when Arabs were primarily nomads at home in the desert. Following this tradition, I named my first son Saeed after my father. I had wanted to name one of my daughters Hanan after my mother, but she objected. She thinks that you only name your child after your parent or brother once they pass away. God forbid. Like many Arab Muslims, my mother kept her own surname after her marriage. When she became pregnant, her sister-in-law, Khadija, who was married to my uncle Faisal, made sure that she received the traditional pregnancy rituals, herbal tea, chicken soup, and warm molasses, all served by Aunt Khadija to celebrate the start of their new family in northern Alberta. I was born on the 7th of December 1977 at Edmonton's Royal Alexandra Hospital. It was the same day that Gordie Howe scored his 1,000th goal against the Birmingham Bulls. My father, then working as a traveling giftware salesman, was in high level about 750 kilometers north of Edmonton. He found out about my birth the following day. When he arrived back home, the first thing my father did was recite the Athan in my ear, "There is no God but God, and Muhammad is the messenger of God." This profession of faith holds a powerful sense of belonging to God and to a community of close to 2 billion people that transcends national and ethnic boundaries, yet shares a spiritual sense of place. The Shahada, "I bear witness that there is no deity, none truly to be worshipped, but Allah, and I bear witness that Muhammad is the messenger of Allah," is the fundamental tenet of the Islamic faith. It forms part of the call to prayer, the Adhan, which draws Muslims to a place of worship 5 times each day: Fajr, dawn; Dahr, midday; Asr, late afternoon; Maghrib, shortly after sunset; and Isha, when total darkness falls. Broadcast from loudspeakers high atop mosques, these calls reach out to the community, bringing everyone together, all turning to face the Kaaba, the holiest of places in Islam, that is located near the center of the Masjid al-Haram, the great mosque in the holy city of Mecca. In some places, like deserts or prairies, the call to prayer can be heard from far, far away. It is a cinematic cliché, a minaret silhouetted against the early dawn sky, the lonely voice of the muezzin echoing across the soundtrack, an evocation of the exotic, the unknown. But in the opening credits of my own life, my father spoke the Shahada to me to wish peace upon my life, to honor my potential and our growth as a Muslim family, a Palestinian family, trying to stay warm in an Edmonton December. When my father held me for the first time at Edmonton, I was an anonymous Palestinian-Canadian baby waiting for the honor of being named. Like many fathers, he thought hard about naming me Muhammad. Instead, he chose Muafa, the name of my mother's brother who had passed away a few months earlier. I've never learned the full story, but Uncle Muafa had been involved with a paramilitary group rumored to be affiliated with Yasser Arafat's Fatah, the dominant faction within the Palestinian Liberation Organization, and had ended up in exile in Sweden. Uncle Muafa died in nebulous circumstances in a car accident in Sweden. The official version of his death is that the brakes on his car accidentally failed, but my family remained convinced that Uncle Muafa was killed under mysterious circumstances. My grandmother always claimed his death was linked to Israeli intelligence services operations, but this has never been confirmed. As individuals, Palestinians may be treated politely, but collectively we are regarded as terrorists, the unwanted or the undesirables. We belong to an invented race, a people defined not by bloodlines but by faith, our piety routinely mistaken for militancy. Rarely are we recognized as displaced persons, as uprooted families searching for an escape, people trying to cope with the pain of survival in an ongoing genocide. As Palestinians, we must defend our right to a future. We come from a nation now deemed to be imaginary, a nation blamed for its stubborn refusal to acquiesce in the face of its own destruction. In 1993, when I went to apply for my birth certificate at an Alberta registry office in Edmonton, I was told that I could not list Palestine as my parents' place of birth. This was not an option. So, what was I supposed to say? That my parents were born in Israel? That would not be true. I realized then that I was up against more than just the anti-Muslim racism of particular individuals. This was a legal form of persecution, with institutions conspiring to erase us from the map. My name, Mwafa Saeed Hausa, ties me to my family and to Palestine. That is something no one can take from me. My father became a refugee before he could walk. It was sometime in the summer of 1948, but family memory is vague on the exact dates. Without radio, news came on the night wind of a brutal massacre in the village of Deir Yassin on the outskirts of Jerusalem. Families attacked in their homes, bodies everywhere, some mutilated, women and children killed. In Lida, where my family is from, people tried to calm each other. Maybe the stories are wrong. Maybe it was just a few bad soldiers who did things they're not supposed to do. Maybe it's all been exaggerated. But others were whispering, "No, it was a massacre. There is no hope. We could be next." Rumor was that the attack had been carried out by two Zionist paramilitary organizations, Irgun and Lahi. Not long afterward, fighting broke out in Jaffa, on the coast just south of Tel Aviv, and barely 20 kilometers from Lida. By mid-May, the city was under the control of Israeli forces, and some 40,000 Palestinians had fled, some by land and some by sea. Lida and the neighboring town of Ramla, both strategically important towns in the war, lay just off the main road connecting Tel Aviv and Jaffa to Jerusalem and were clearly in Israel's sights. Fearing another slaughter like the one in Deir Yassin, my grandparents gathered their 9 children together and fled their home on foot. Along with many of their neighbors, they trudged east down the dusty road towards the front lines of Jordan's Arab Legion. "It's just for now, it's just for now," people told each other. "We will go back when it's all been sorted out." Yet, under the unforgiving sun and in the occasional shade of an olive grove, they could feel the despair. Later, they learned that some Palestinians who had remained in Lida, including my 14-year-old uncle Darwish, had fought back. Darwish had survived, but other members of their family had died fighting occupation. My great-grandfather, Abdul Rahman, had been killed while he was transporting weapons from Turkey to fight against the British. Someone from Lida communicated his whereabouts to the British, and he was killed. My family's blood has been spilled for Palestine from the earliest days of occupation. The Israeli occupation of Lida and Ramla was followed by expulsion orders that were signed on the 12th of July, 1948, and given to the Israel Defense Forces by Lieutenant Colonel Yitzhak Rabin. The orders stated that the inhabitants had to be expelled immediately, no matter how old or young. In the end, perhaps as many as 70,000 Palestinians were forced to leave the area, joining roughly 750,000 other Palestinian refugees who had fled or been driven out of their towns during the war and before. Some died from dehydration or from sheer exhaustion during the exodus. Others never even made it that far. They were shot point blank by Israeli forces for refusing to hand over money and valuables. This massive displacement of Palestinians came to be known as Al-Nakba, the catastrophe. The Nakba is soaked into my father's being. His first real home was a leaky tent in a refugee camp in Amman, which lay at the end of the road after the flight from Lida. My grandfather's brother, Uncle Isa, took refuge in the Gaza Strip, a decision he would come to regret as the violence there escalated. My grandfather and his family initially joined Uncle Isa in Gaza, but then my grandfather decided it would be safer to move to Jordan. My grandparents had heard that it was safe in Amman and that Jordan was temporarily welcoming Palestinian refugees until the Arab forces liberated Palestine from Israeli hands, which, of course, never happened. My grandfather's name was Mahmoud. His name, Mahmoud, means the praised one or worthy of reverence, but everyone called him Tuma. Tuma had been a farmer in Lida. He had also worked as a farmer and nighttime security guard during the British occupation of Palestine. He owned a home, his own land. When I close my eyes, I can imagine him, tall and proud, and hear his voice. He was in his early 30s in 1948 when he was forced to abandon his land, and his independence abruptly gave way to vulnerability. As a refugee in Jordan, Tuma found work as a gardener, turning the earth with his hands to feed his family. Whenever he could, he shared generously with his neighbors, giving them the choice of the produce he was able to procure. A humble and pious man, my grandfather looked only to plant new roots in this foreign land and to raise his family with love and give them a secure future. The call to prayer was deep within my grandfather. Every morning he would pull himself away from the rest of the family and from the warmth of everyone cuddling together in the tent. At times it was so cold outside that he had to break the surface ice on the water for wudu, ablutions before prayer. As the Fajr prayer left his lips, his breath would float out on the winter dawn, rooting him in his faith amid loss and upheaval. I recall my father telling me that story during our family reunion in Calgary in 2013. He agreed that evening before dinner to let me record some of his stories, so I can still hear his scratchy voice share the experiences of his parents, and how his voice aches when he relates the death of one of his brothers in 1960. When Uncle Faisal, who was working in Germany at the time, heard that Uncle Assad had been diagnosed with leukemia, he arranged for him to come to Germany and stay with him so that he could care for him and take care of any expenses. My dad remembered watching as Tuma hugged Assad and said, "Son, take care of yourself. I fear I will never see you again." Assad died a few weeks later in a German hospital. My grandparents wept together but accepted that Uncle Assad's death was God's will. They refused to bury their son in Germany. It had to be Palestine. If it couldn't be Lida, then at least it could be somewhere in the West Bank, an area then under Jordanian control. They chose Nabi Musa in the desert wilderness south of Jericho, the site of the tomb of the prophet Moses. It was, they said, a good place for Assad to rest. Just 7 years later, his grave would lie in Israeli-occupied territory. After burying his son, Tuma returned to Jordan. He thought often of Palestine, the only real home he had known, the place where his father Darwish, his grandfather Abdul Rahman, and his great-grandfather Khalil were born. The land of abundance had been ripped apart by the war, and Tuma dreamt how he and his neighbors lived once again like nomads, in tents. He hoped there would be better days ahead for families like theirs. 3. A Circle of Tears. When I was in my early 20s, I traveled to Palestine to seek my own roots under the Nakba tree. As I sought to understand the trail of sorrow my grandparents walked, I found my journal filling up with stories about family ties. Together, the Palestinian territories cover an area only slightly larger than Prince Edward Island. Wherever you go, if you ask about a name, you're likely to find someone who will lead you to the person or family you are looking for. In this way, I met many people who were related to either my father or my mother. I felt a sense of belonging that had always eluded me in Canada, a home in which I often felt like an unwelcome guest. My time in Palestine coincided with the start of the Second Intifada in September 2000. I spent a week in Hebron visiting my cousin Reham and her husband Yusuf. Situated about 30 kilometers south of Jerusalem, Hebron lies in the occupied West Bank and has long been a flashpoint in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Several years before I arrived, the city had been divided into two zones, with the Israeli army in control of about a fifth of the territory and the rest administered by the Palestinian Authority, PA. Virtually the entire population is Palestinian, more than 200,000 people, roughly 30,000 of whom live in the Israeli zone. The Jewish settlers, who number well under 1,000, live under military guard, surrounded by Palestinians. While I was in Hebron, I ended up serving as a translator for a Canadian photographer and an Irish journalist. In the old quarter of the city with its crumbling city walls, we talked to one of the many families who had been living under Israeli curfew since Ariel Sharon's visit to the Haram es-Sharif, or Temple Mount as it is known in English. They face food shortages, inadequate access to health services, and no garbage removal. Schools were closed, and some had been taken over by the Israeli Defense Forces for use as military bases. We asked a young man named Ashraf how he was coping under these conditions. "I'm married and I have a little boy," he said. "I can't work and I can't buy medicine for my child. I feel helpless because I must support two families. But we are getting used to these conditions. This is not the first time that this has happened. It happened during the first Intifada too. But this time the rules are much stricter. The soldiers and the settlers are even more violent." Ashraf was my age, 22. "A year and a half ago," he told us, "I was in prison for 3 months and no one knew where I was. My family found out where I was when they were contacted to come and fetch me after my release. The soldiers and settlers beat, tortured, and humiliated me. Before they took me to prison, they blindfolded me, tied me up, and placed me in the middle of a crowd of Israeli settlers. I was tied down, and people who walked by me would curse at me and call me a dirty Arab, then either kick me, slap me, or spit at me. They would feed me food that was repulsive. Sometimes I would watch the settlers as they fed their dogs in pretty glass plates with good food. They played with the dog and nurtured it as I sat there watching. I would at times wish I were that dog. But what can we do? We have adapted to this way of life." Ashraf's mother was less reconciled to their situation. "He is my only son," she said. "In any other country, the only son is treated well because he is the sole provider for the family. But not here. Not here. We have no money. Our food supplies are dwindling. There are some good people who sometimes put meat and vegetables in front of the house. But we can't live like this forever." She and her extended family, 15 people in all, were huddled together in a cramped living space. They lived in a neighborhood that was often by Israeli forces, and curfews were frequently at all hours of the day. Anyone found on the street after 1 o'clock in the afternoon, she said, would be beaten or arrested, but she and other family members sometimes took the risk to get medicine or milk for the children. "I never send my son out for errands," Ashraf's mother told us. "I go instead because I know that if the soldiers catch my son, they will do horrible things to him. My son, my only son, Ashraf, has been arrested many times, and he has been beaten, imprisoned, and humiliated by both the settlers and the soldiers. I am a widow. He's my only son. If anything happens to him, the family will have no other means to survive." Her voice rose and cracked before she burst into tears. I understood the words, but I groped for some way to translate what she was saying. "This could have been my family," I kept thinking. "This woman could have been my mother, and I the son who has been abused and thrown into prison. Or she could be Grandma Nima, and the young man my father." Everyone was a captive here. Unable to speak evenly, I caught my breath and glanced at the journalist and photographer. "I have asthma," I explained. "I do have asthma, but that wasn't the problem in this moment." The stifling atmosphere broke slightly when Ashraf took us for a tour on the roof. "You see how we place cement brick barriers around the water tanks to protect them from bullets," Ashraf pointed out. Improvising, even with the basics. I could see the bullet holes in the cement blocks. My mind flashed to my father's childhood, when his family needed water, and I thought of him later in life, when he worked in a cement factory and then in sales. Standing there on that rooftop listening to Ashraf and his mother speak, the past, the present, and imagined futures all blurred together. Only weeks before I visited Hebron in October 2000, Muhammad Al-Dura died in the Gaza Strip. He was 12 years old. Caught in the middle of heavy crossfire, he and his father Jamal were filmed by a Palestinian cameraman as they crouched behind a concrete barrel set against a concrete wall, both of them clad in jeans and scuffed-up sneakers. In the clip, Jamal reaches out an arm, trying to shield his son, who is sobbing, terror-stricken. Jamal waves frantically. There is a swirl of dust, and Muhammad lies dead across his father's legs. This brief clip became highly controversial. Was Muhammad really dead? Skeptics asked. And if he was, then how do we know it was Israeli soldiers who shot him? Was the entire sequence staged? Detailed investigations and ballistics reports followed, with Israelis claiming that it was all a plot to defame the country, and Palestinians reacting with outrage to such allegations. In an atmosphere of bitter polarization, finding the truth acquires an exaggerated meaning. It was as if the legitimacy of the entire Palestinian struggle depended on the authenticity of this one image. There are countless other images, two-dimensional snaps of this reality that is three generations deep. Fathers and mothers cradling their children, victims of rocket attacks on Gaza, whether in 2000 or 2006, 2014 or 2021. Kids pierced and burned by shrapnel, rushed into overburdened hospitals. Family portraits of smiling faces covered in concrete dust in the rubble of living rooms. While I was in Palestine, I would often, too often, hear parents cry on the news. What did my child do to die like this? What was his mistake? She was 11 months old. He was 5 years old. She was 12 years old. What did they do? Those voices have echoed in my head from the day I first heard them. In December 2013, when my family gathered in Calgary, I was about to become the father to my third child. After our dinner table conversation, my father had agreed to let me record his stories, for me and for his children's children. I held my mobile phone recording device close to preserve my father's voice, hoping somehow to liberate him from the exhaustion weighing on his spirit. I did not know then that, only 8 months later, right in the middle of the International Year of Solidarity with the Palestinian people, Gaza would experience a summer of almost inconceivable destruction that would kill more than 2,250 members of my extended family, including 550 children. According to the United Nations Human Rights Council's report of the Independent Commission of Inquiry on the 2014 Gaza conflict, some 11,230 people were wounded, 30% of them children. 18,000 homes were obliterated. Blood would be shed at checkpoints, and our people would die beneath concrete chunks of their broken homes. The violence would split our hearts across hemispheres. Living in exile, we try to find some way to heal from the sorrows of displacement. We do our best to come to terms with our situation, to cross beyond the physical and mental checkpoints that prevent us from accessing our new home and a new identity fully, or from returning to our ancestral homes. But it is not easy to heal when the wounds are constantly reopened.